Persons Committee, to order. Time is 3:33, 14th of February. Today we will hear from Kathy Forrester from the AOGCC and Dan Seamount from the AOGCC. And in the audience, we have Pedro Van Meers, Dr. Van Meers, who's been presenting to us most of the last 2 days. And for anybody else. With that, unless there's anything further, I'll ask who's going to go first? Mr. Seamount or?
We're going to tag team.
Oh, well, both of you come up and identify yourselves and welcome to Senate Resources.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee for inviting us to come and testify today. For the record, my name is Dan Seamount. I'm the Geologist Commissioner of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and I'm the chair of the AOGCC for the next 2 weeks when I'm abdicating my chairship to someone new.
And for the record, I'm Kathy Forrester. I'm the engineering commissioner of the AOGCC. And I'm going to roll my eyes when Dan says stupid things and then add something in at the end.
And I hope that everybody laughs with Kathy and at me. Oh, I got that backwards, didn't I? Okay. Let's see if I can figure... This is a different PowerPoint than I usually have. Oh, view. Here we go. Oh.
Will you give him a grandson?
Yeah. Okay, that must be a new version of PowerPoint than we can afford.
Well, we get started, I'd like the record to reflect that we've been joined by Senator Geisel.
We were asked to come testify about North Slope production and activity today. So in lieu of the normal cover slide, I decided to put up a picture of our North Slope office at Dead Horse, Alaska. And these pictures were taken just a few days ago, and that's our facilities up there. Down below you can see a picture of the of a temperature gauge that was taken on February 1st, and it says 60 below. 60 below is not that newsworthy or exciting, but you notice that the inspector that's holding the temperature gauge is not wearing gloves, which indicates how tough our inspectors are.
There's other words for that.
No, they don't take after me. Okay, so as I say, we're talking about the Alaska North Slope. It's an area about the size of Wyoming. It's a huge area. And you can see on this slide where all the production is. It's a very small area, maybe the size of Rhode Island, where the production is coming from. As you all know, there's a tremendous amount of potential throughout the area. This is a slide that Commissioner Forrester used in her testimony for HGR 29, which has to do with the BLM legacy wells. And I left those legacy wells on there not to talk about the resolution, but to show you that that's about all the control that we have through the area out to the west of the North Slope oil fields. That's a huge area, probably the size of Ohio, where there are very few penetrations. The information we have on those wells is not very complete.
Mr. Chairman, so,
excuse me a minute. Senator Stedman.
Could you, Dan, can you define that when you say not very complete? Is the information held by another entity or just not available because of the technology at the time when it was drilled, or why? Or is it just that they're so spread out it doesn't give you much data source? Or
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, all that's correct. And the BLM holds most of the information. We haven't seen all of it, but what we have is very minimal, and you know, they're old wells with old old ways of collecting information. So it's not like these modern wells where you can do all this evaluation, but at the least we do know whether they encountered oil or gas in these wells.
Can I have a follow-up? Is there core samples still saved from those drillings, or are they lost?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I don't know. We can check on that. They would probably be stored either in Denver at the USGS or at our core facility, Geologic Material Center in Eagle River.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, and what would be the years when these wells were drilled? Could you give them a span of?
They were from the 40s through the 60s, 80s.
Through the 80s, I think.
Early 80s.
But most were probably pre-70. Okay, this slide here of the Alaska North Slope producing fields, this is the only oil production we have at this time on the North Slope. Tremendous potential up there, and you can look at this slide at your own leisure to identify where these fields are. Of course, you probably all know anyway. This is a cover slide that we've used in previous presentations. And the reason I'm showing it is it's a picture of Alpine Oil Field, which was discovered in 1994 and started regular production in 2002. And the reason I'm showing this is it's an example of the tremendous strides in technology, which has enabled the drilling of a very small footprint. And they're drilling wells up to 5 miles out. They're draining 20,000 acres, which is 31 square miles, from one 13-acre pad. And the future looks even better as far as technology. It's just amazing. I've been in this business for 40 years, and it just amazes me how far technology's gone. There are things that 20 years ago, you know, we hadn't even thought about that they're doing. And you know, one thing is the extended reach, but the other thing is they're producing oil out of shale and gas out of shale, which, you know, speaking as a geologist, that was impossible just 10 years ago in my book. And I'm confident that technology is going to continue to advance. Here's what I plan to talk about today. The AOGCC mission, abbreviated, I think you all know what we do. I'm just going to go through it real quickly just for the record and for the public, unless you feel that I don't need to, Mr. Chairman. And
go ahead and go through it briefly so the public that's on the camera can understand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then
as a matter of fact, tell them what AOGCC means.
Okay, I will. I will do that. Okay. And then I'll go through what both Commissioner Forrester and I did last year to a couple of committees, and that's historical AOGCC oil and gas permitting activity and actual work done on the North Slope. Now, like I say, we showed it last year. Basically, what we're going to show you today is just one extra point, 1 year of information. And I'm going to tell you that the change is not all that exciting. But, you know, you guys see a much bigger picture than we do, and you may be able to, you know, decipher some sort of more definite trends out of it than we showed you last year. After I'm done, then Commissioner Forrester is going to talk about, is going to answer some questions that Chairman Pascavan asked her in an email, which involves reservoir technology. Okay, slide number 6. The AOGCC is the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and some of the people that talk too much in the office, I'm going to tell them that it is not the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, but Conservation Commission. We're a quasi-judicial state regulatory agency. We have oversight mainly over underground oil and gas reservoirs, and we do that wherever the state police have powers. and that is over private, federal, and state lands. We regulate the drilling and development of oil and gas and geothermal resources. Lately, underground storage of natural gas has become a big deal in Cook Inlet, and so we've stuck that in there. Just that's part of number one, but we're going to emphasize that a bit because it's going to help out a lot of Cook Inlet. And one of the few things we do on the surface is we ensure metering accuracy for custody transfer. Slide number seven. The first two bullet points have to do with conservation. That is, we prevent the waste of energy resources, promote greater ultimate energy resource recovery, and then equally important, the third bullet, we protect underground sources of fresh water. Equally important, we protect human safety when it comes to operations in the oil field, and we also protect relative rights. Those are the rights of owners that have adjacent properties to production. Slide number eight is fairly busy. You've all seen it before, except for one exception. Since this is a talk on North Slope, we have split out the North Slope drilling permits, and this slide shows the blue with the dots on it shows the permitting number of permits we've adjudicated per year since inception, which was in 1957. And the total ones are the solid line. The North Slope permits are shown in the line defined by the shaded blue. And you can see that the North Slope, after the 1970s, the North Slope was by far the area with the most activity in the state. The little sliver between the solid line and the North Slope line is mainly Cook Inlet. I don't know if I need to go into detail. The first hump here would be big gas field development in Cook Inlet. Then the next big hump was the oil development in Cook Inlet, with some, before 1970, some exploration in on the North Slope, resulted in Prudhoe Bay. And then the big hump in around 1980 was development drilling within mainly Prudhoe Bay and Kuparik, and then after that, a lot of satellite development. Commissioner Forrester, did you want to expand a little bit on that? I know that's a real quick way to describe this curve here, but
you did a lovely job.
Okay, thank you. All right. The green. Oh, and you can see that the numbers of wells drilled varied between almost zero in the 1950s to the peak in 1982, I believe, with over 300. With about 275 in on the North Slope. And you can see that there's been a little downturn in the last year, and you can actually see a trend in permits that started around 2005. And for the most part, the number of permits that we've been adjudicating has been going down, and we're at a low now over the last 12 years. In fact, the only time it was lower over the last almost 20 years was in 1999, which was a year after the extremely low oil prices. The green curve is the numbers of active wells that we have to deal with. And those are the wells that our inspectors have to do some sort of observation on, and you can see it's steadily grown through the years, and we're at an all-time high of about 4,800 active wells now. The magenta curve is the number of active oil reservoirs in the state, and you can see it's continued to climb, fairly fast between 2000 and 2005, and there's been less oil reservoirs identified and discovered since 2005. Slide number nine is a slide that we showed last year, and that shows a timeline of North Slope oil fields. The asterisk, the star, is when the discovery well was drilled. The brownish part of the bar is while the field was being drilled for development, and the green, where the green starts, is where a regular production started. And if you look at the average time to production from discovery, taking out the five of the, you know, of the most delayed fields, the average is 11 years from time to time of discovery to active production is 11 years. And if you look at fields that where we think that the operator tried as hard as they could to get the field on production, such as Alpine and I believe it was Uguric, that's a 7-year timeline. So 7 years from discovery to regular production. Slide number 10, you've seen this slide before.
Any idea how that compares? Everybody's always comparing us to North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana. I know there's a lot of difference between drilling and going into production on North Slope and in the plays in North Dakota. But do you have any idea how long from the time a well's drilled in North Dakota in the Bakken until it's into production?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have specific numbers on that, but I know it's very fast.
Very fast. From what, very quick, because they aren't worried about pipelines. They truck it if they have to. Is that correct? So we're looking at an entirely different system of development. That's the point I wanted to make. We're totally developing with pipelines and taking it to the treating units and everything else compared to their they drill, produce, and transport there very quickly.
Senator Wagner, part of the difference is when you drill an exploratory well in the lower 48, you typically keep that well and it's your first producer, whereas on the North Slope, most of our exploratory wells are throwaway wells. They're not drilled in such a way that you can keep them and turn them around and produce them. You drill them just for the data because your chances of finding a successful development opportunity are low enough that you don't put as much investment into the capability of the well. You just put the investment into the data gathering. And so at the end of drilling an exploratory well in the lower 48, all they have to do is open a valve and they're ready to go. And we have to start all over and wait for the next winter exploration season and keep gathering data.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, we can give you 10 other reasons why it's slower if you had the time to listen.
Well, I just want the people out there in the listening audience or the viewing audience basically to understand that there's a tremendous difference between developing an oil field on the North Slope and one lower 48. Thank you.
Okay, slide number 10. This slide shows Alaska's average daily oil and NGL productions from 1960 to 2011, and I'm sure you're all very familiar with this slide. What it shows is in the late 60s through the 70s, Cook Inlet was the top producer in the state, producing 285,000 barrels of oil per day in the early 70s until Prudhoe Bay came online. And in the 70s, and the Kuparuk-Milne Point in the 80s, and everybody ran to the North Slope. And as I showed before, even though everybody ran the North Slope is still way underexplored, as I think Cook Inlet's underexplored, but that's for a different day to talk about. I think that's probably all. That curve has probably been beat to death through other hearings, so I won't say any more about that.
Chairman,
Senator French.
So while we do have that, we have talked a lot about this curve, but there's a reason, and it's because it's so important. I understand that one of my colleagues sent you an article that came out of the Oil and Gas Journal back in '92, and it was a couple of senior ARCO people talking about the decline of Prudhoe. And the article had some interesting and kind of provocative quotes in it. One of those quotes was this, that by any definition, Prudhoe Bay is declining and will continue to decline. Again, this is from 1992. To accountants, the Prudhoe Bay decline began in 1988 when the field was no longer able to make its maximum allowable rate. of 1.5 million barrels of oil a day. To engineers, the decline began long before that. And I wonder if you could just kind of comment on the Prudhoe decline and what you think is even possible out of that reservoir at this point in time.
Senator French, I'll defer to the expert reservoir engineer on that one. If it's okay, Mr. Chairman.
That's fine.
Senator French, through the chair, I heard a lot of questions in that one question. I think first, when they were saying that the decline started sooner for the engineers, what that meant was that a lot of engineering work went into keeping the rate at the allowable, that if they had simply drilled up the field, considered it developed, and then let it go, decline would have started a lot sooner. So there was a lot of investment, a lot of engineering, a lot of geology, a lot of thought, activity, and money spent to maintain the plateau for as long as they did. The Prudhoe Bay Reservoir, and you'll probably have to hear me say this again in about 10 minutes, but the Prudhoe Bay Reservoir is just world-class. It's the largest reservoir in North America. When it was discovered in the 70s, the plan then was, some of you were here, I think, then the plan was to have a gas pipeline as well. And with the then current technology, the thought was they'd water flood it, they'd blow down a little gas along the way. And if that plan had followed through, we would have depleted Prudhoe Bay with about 8 billion barrels of production. We've produced over 11 so far, and that has been due to that same engineering and geology and thinking and money spending to keep the decline from just screaming down like it would have. But with over 11 billion barrels produced so far, there's still about 2 billion barrels left technically recoverable from the Prudhoe Reservoir. And to put that in perspective, Thunder Horse was the biggest discovery in North America in this millennium, and it's less than 2 billion barrels. So the biggest discovery in this millennium in this continent at inception is smaller than Prudhoe Bay, what the leftovers are still at Prudhoe Bay.
Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dan, I know you don't want to get too involved in this, but you did say that North Slope and Cook Inlet is way underexplored, and you said that you could spend days, I suppose hours, on that. But could you give us a brief, what makes you say that?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, you mean why would I say that both are underexplored? Or?
Yeah, I mean, what would lead you to believe it's underexplored? Because there's lots of areas that have not been explored, or because you think there are large reservoirs out there in both areas? Just give me a brief.
Yes, both. There are huge areas between well control that have not been explored. There are known structures that haven't been drilled on the North Slope. In Cook Inlet Basin is the same size as the San Juan Basin in New Mexico, which has 29,000 wells in it, and they're still making discoveries there. In Cook Inlet, there's 1,000 wells that have been drilled, and only of those, only about, less than 400 wells have been exploratory. And that's, I mean, that's, in my opinion, that's way underexplored. There are plays that work throughout the world that they have never actually gone after in Cook Inlet, and some not even on the North Slope.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 2 billion barrels left in Prudhoe Bay, is this, how challenged is this oil, and do you have a sense of what the cost structure would be to cost per barrel?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, the 2 billion barrels that I discussed is the 2 billion barrels that we expect that the operator will produce. It's technically recoverable today, and the challenges that exist for that 2 billion barrels are, one, oil price, two, how it's transported should the total North Slope rate drop below that at which taps can operate, and the mechanical integrity of the aging infrastructure. But it's there, it's technically recoverable, and it's in wells that have been already drilled or replacement and infill wells that are easily drilled.
Just if I could follow up on that, Mr. Chair. Do you, and I asked about cost structure, and I'm just curious, The 2 billion barrels, you expect it to be produced, do you expect it to be produced under the current tax structure? Are you able to answer that?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I've only been in the state 20 years, and the tax structure has changed at least five times that I know of. So to say that it would be developed under the current tax structure would be a bit naive. I haven't seen tax fiscal stability.
Well, I guess,
but I think that would be good.
But I guess that's, if I could, Mr. Chair, I guess that's why I'm trying to get at cost. Do you have a sense of what the cost per barrel would be? I mean, is it economically recoverable under the current tax structure?
I haven't looked enough at the economics to answer that question.
Okay, thanks.
Through the chair.
Senator French.
The number of tax changes, you're counting five in the last 20 years?
That was hyperbole. I was just pulling the number. But we've had ACEs, we've had...
PPT, and before that, some people count... ELF took place in 1989, so I think that's more than 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's right before I got here.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I appreciate the hyperbole, but the cameras are running, and we take a lot of heat for these oil tax changes, so that's a number that I'm
so it's more like three or four?
Actually, it sounds like three is the most you get in 20 years, and that's if you count when Governor Murkowski aggregated the fields of Prudhoe. So I think there's that one, there's PPT, and there's ACES, because ELF took place in 1989. Okay, thank you. Just for the record.
Just for the record. Thank you, Senator French. I got a question. We spent considerable time. We had a presentation for 3 days on the Gleason court case. And the presenters said that the decline curve, they felt, with the proper investments, could be flattened out and even raised up some. But from everything I've looked at, I haven't heard anybody say that we're going to be able to, just with what's in Prudhoe Bay, to stop that decline curve, maybe slow it down a little. But the only thing I think on this graph you've got here, the only thing that I think that would level that out, correct me if I'm wrong, would be new discoveries and new production from new fields.
Senator Wagner, it would take an enormous investment at Prudhoe Bay to stop decline in that field.
Yeah.
And I would agree with you that in order to stabilize production at its current rate, we would need to make some new discoveries, have some new technologies, and spend a lot of money in existing fields. We need all of that.
Thank you.
And I agree with that too, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr.
And there are places where you can do that. Okay, slide number 11 shows, it's a pie chart that shows what kinds and how many of each well were drilled throughout Alaska last year. We showed a similar slide for 2010 last year where we had a total of 183 wells drilled. We're saying that there will be at least 140 wells. There were at least 140 wells drilled. And there may be a few that haven't been reported on yet, but it's going to be a pretty 2011 is a pretty slow year. If you will look at it at the pie chart, by far the majority were drilled on the North Slope. There were 125 on the North Slope. There were 15 in Cook Inlet. There's one geothermal well and one UCG well. Well, there are actually five alternate energy wells, geothermal and underground coal gasification wells. The North Slope is by far the most important when it comes to activity. However, activity is ramping up in Cook Inlet. We've got a jackup that's actually drilled out there, another one on the way. They're starting to look at different play types in Cook Inlet, so Cook Inlet could become much more important in the future. But today we're talking about North Slope. Let's see. Oh, to expand upon your comment about new discoveries being needed, you can see on this map here, there's huge area, NPRA, of course, there's the OCS. We all know this. There's a big area of state leases, which are in a very good spot when you talk about shale oil and shale gas. And, of course, there's Anwar out there. So,
Chairman?
Senator Grinch?
Just while we've got that slide up, maybe you can explain to the public how far out your jurisdiction goes into those waters.
Well, our jurisdiction goes 3 miles out into the waters. And if they drill from shore, then we will have jurisdiction from a safety standpoint, not from a reservoir development standpoint.
Thank you. And whose jurisdiction picks that up afterwards?
Through the chair.
I know it's the feds, but which agency would you sort of name as the lead agency?
The names keep changing. I'm not sure what the latest name is.
Bureau of Ocean Energy Management.
Oh, yeah, BOEMRI. Yeah, right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, actually, that's been split out.
No, it's VOEM. It's
VOEM. Okay. slide number 12. I went too far. We've already, slide number 12 is the production curve for Alaska with Cook Inlet taken out. Looks very similar to the slide we just went into a lot of detail discussing. One thing I'd like to point out is in, I think it was 1998, the president of ARCO, what was his name?
Ken Thompson.
Ken Thompson, his motto was no decline in 99 and...
After
99, and he was right for a number of years up till about 2005, and that was with the development of the Alpine Field. So that gives me optimism that maybe we can arrest the decline in other ways. But, you know, I didn't believe him at the time.
Yeah, there was a, by one of our previous presenters, there was some discussion on how Elephant Field's production cycles lay out in time, and they were talking about a parabolic curve, as I recall. What's your expectations of how Elephant Fields produce over the long run in their production curves? Is this abnormal, normal, or should we be pumping 2 million barrels a day since 1987? Or
Mr. Forrester?
You're looking at an Elephant Field right there, and it's a pretty well-managed one, and it's pretty... I would say that what we have seen at Prudhoe Bay as the production trends from an Elephant Field that was developed by the best operators in the country is a good go-by.
And I'm not a reservoir engineer, so I may be speaking out of school, but the recovery rates at Prudhoe Bay are incredible.
Yeah.
Senator Stedman?
As a follow-up, I think, as I recall that testimony, I don't have it in front of me, but as I recall it, they were talking about a flattening out of the production and a long tail on these elephant fields. Is that something we should expect, or do you disagree with that?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, yes, that's exactly what we should expect at Prudhoe Bay.
Okay, we're at slide number 14. This chart displays the timing of prominent discoveries on the North Slope and the number of exploration wells drilled, and it goes back to 1950. The legacy wells at the NPRA are not on this chart, but you can see the number of wells and well bores that were exploration wells and well bores that were drilled varied between, you know, a very small number, like 2 per year, to the maximum was like 32. And it looks like typical since 1980 was, you know, looks like maybe 7 wells a year. There have been reports recently in the media that there could be more than 35 wells drilled this year. On the very right, we have a different colored bar, which is not actual wells drilled. These are the number of permits the AOGCC has received for drilling this season on the North Slope. And at this point, it's about 8, maybe 9. And I would say that probably we're going to have at least that many wells drilled this season. We probably will not have less wells than that drilled, and we may have more. But we don't see the 30-some wells unless we start getting some applications in. It's getting kind of late in the season.
Run that by me one more time. How many wells do you expect? What's your optimum number at this time?
I would say probable would be 8 to 10. Okay. And possible, I mean, 15 would be a lot. And, you know, it takes us time to process an exploration drilling permit. So if someone really wants to drill before the ice goes out, we need to see those permits.
And that's coming up soon, right?
Yes.
Senator French.
Thank you. You know, you look at that chart, and it's a little hard to see on the screen, but it's easier to see in the printed slide. It looks like exploration is cyclical. And last year, you know, we talked to Ms. Forster about this, and you said at the time, you know, don't be too concerned about that low number we saw last year in 2011, you know, unless the decline sort of stays down there for several years. Now we're getting a nice, healthy bump up. We don't know how healthy it is, but it's certainly better than last year. Looks more in line with history. Can you talk about the cyclical nature of the number of exploration wells that get drilled every year and maybe why there might be a cycle to that?
Through the chair, Senator French, that is a very difficult question to answer. When I was in the business, we'd drill more wells when the oil price was up and less wells when the oil price was down. You know, the oil price is up now, and we're not. I mean, 10 wells. That makes me pretty happy that we may have 10 exploration wells drilled this year, because it's certainly a lot better than the dismal last year. Commissioner Forster, do you have any thoughts on that? If it's okay with Mr. Chairman,
through the chair, that's exactly what I was going to say. When the oil price is high, you got a big budget, and you spend it on drilling wells. When the oil price is low, you don't have any budget.
Thank you.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. It was just reported in Petroleum News, which I think is a pretty credible publication, that, and it's actually this week. It was the week of February 12th. And it says this brings the total number of 2012 Northern Soap explorers to 6 and the total oil exploration wells to between 23 and 27. And just wondering if you have any idea where that disparity may come from.
Senator Wilkowski, no, I don't. I don't know where the disparity comes from. All I know is the numbers of permits we've received.
Senator French.
It is probably worth pointing out, because some people, when they hear the word permit, they think, oh, my God, it takes a year to process a permit. We talked about that earlier today. About how long does it take your agency to process a permit for an exploration well?
Well, the average well, including development wells, is about 7 working days. I'd say for an explorer, we haven't broken exploration wells out. We could, but it'd probably be less than 2 weeks.
So thank you. I mean, it's just a good number to keep in mind.
It is conceivable we could see 35 permits come in tomorrow.
Well, I hope so, because the chairman and I have a Coke riding on us. I really, I'm losing the Coke right now. It'd be nice if the number got up.
Senator French, through the chair, the length of time it takes us to process an exploratory well permit is dependent on not just the complexity of the well, but the completeness of the application. And as new operators come to the state, operators that don't know how to work within our regulatory structure, we spend a lot of time teaching them, and it takes a lot of time. You know, so it's conceivable that a new operator's first permit could take months to be complete. And you know, we start our clock on processing a permit when that permit application is complete. So from the time an operator first sent in a piece of paper, could be months. But that's not a reflection on our inability to process the paperwork. It's on the operator's ability to give us everything we need.
Just last point on this. I think I remember reading that Conoco was a company that was suddenly announcing plans for an exploration well. Did that news reach your desk or your awareness? And that's good, great news. I'm glad to hear that.
Well, let's go to the next slide.
Here we go. Great.
This slide is the last slide, only it's expanded. It's only from 1997, and it shows the number the operators who have drilled these exploration wells. ConocoPhillips and BP were by far the big guys up until 2002, and then you start seeing new operators come in. So far this year, if you go all the way to 2012, and the question mark over it, so it shows these are not wells that were drilled; these were just permits that we've received. We've got three from Repsol. It looks like two from Pioneer, one from Brooks Range, and one from ExxonMobil. No, that's ConocoPhillips. Okay, we did get one from ConocoPhillips, but just one, it looks like.
Thank you.
The next slide, number 16, shows development and service wells, well bores drilled from 1950 to 2011. You can see that 2011 was a slow year, and it looks like there was a time between, well, in 1999 there was a real slowdown. That's when the price of oil just took a nosedive, and then we come back up to a respectable number of development wells drilled, like around 190 up until 2005, and then it just dropped off around 2005. And other than a couple of years where the trend has been broken, it looks like there's a downtrend in the number of wells, development wells being drilled, the wells that are drilled to keep the oil field going.
And just a comment on this.
Senator French.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Probably one of the most remarkable swings, and it's hard to tell from that chart exactly what year it is, but I'll just say it looks like from maybe 99 to 2000 or 98 to 99, but you go from 250 wells drilled one year to 100, just to over 100 the next. I mean, a swing of almost 150 wells in a single year. Any comment on that?
Okay, if you go to slide number 17, we can focus in on that time period better. And
oh, there you go. Yeah, it's 98 to 99. Thanks.
Yep. Yeah, the price of oil really dove at that time. It dove so bad that I was working for Unocal. We were not making money in Cook Inlet, and we were just about ready to shut down. In fact, we did try to sell our assets at that time. But that was a total price related dive. Now, I don't understand why from 2005 to 2011 the price of oil is basically screaming up. We don't see an increase in activity. And that's something you'd have to ask the operators. The other thing about slide number 11 is it shows that in 2008 we started to get some new operators on the slope. That's a good thing. Hopefully, we'll see more coming up, the more the merrier. Slide number.
Quick question. In North Slope Borough, that was a gas well, wasn't it?
Yes, Mr. Yeah. Chairman. There's been a number of gas wells at North Slope Borough's drilling or planning to drill.
Thank you.
Slide number 18 is similar to the other slide that shows the same sorts of trends, but this is just total footage drilled on the north slope, and you see the same sort of thing, and it's divided out into development, exploratory, and service wells. So the service and development wells are the wells that keep the production going or assist in keeping the production going in the known fields.
Mr. Chairman.
But you see the same trends.
Senator Wilkowski.
Horizontal or vertical footage?
Senator Wilkowski, this would be total, both. It would be total, yeah. It would be length of the well bore.
And just while we're on this point, this takes into account multiple completions, for example, from a single well bore. I mean, you wouldn't, so if you go down, you've got two different completions, you get, 8,000 feet down, 1,000 feet this way, another 1,000 feet this way, it looks like 10,000 altogether.
That's correct.
Thank you.
No double counting.
You don't count the wellbore twice. You just count
No.
I got your
Always want to watch.
I think one of the reasons we wanted to show activity this way was because it kind of levels things out. It well count can be deceptive. If the wells are complicated and it takes a number of days to drill them, you can spend a month on one well and then a week on another well. So, or if, as Senator French says, you drill a multilateral and you drill 8,000 feet and then you do five branches each of 500 feet, that can look like a lot of wells in a very little time. So this kind of averages it out into total footage drilled. A drill rig is there to drill, and the time that it spends drilling is what this is trying to
do. Yeah, it's not a number I'm accustomed to seeing, but it really does seem very, very helpful to just sort of put it in context. Get off the. We tend to sort of overemphasize the number of wells, like that's the only measure. And this is interesting. And just while we're on the subject of laterals, how many, I mean, I said two, but I mean, how many laterals can you get from a single well bore? What do you mean generally?
Senator French, through the chair, the most that I've counted from a single well is around five in Alaska.
Okay. And are multiple completions now the standard? They're the norm, would you say, or no?
Senator French, I think it's all over the board. There are multilaterals and there
hard to generalize.
It's hard to generalize.
Excuse me. But I think
Senator Wilkowski.
Is there fracking going on from these wellbores?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. In Alaska, we've been fracking since the 1960s, and right at current well count, approximately 25% of Alaska's wells have been hydraulically fractured.
Would that impact because you're fracking? Would that lessen the amount of footage you need to drill?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, you get in contact with more of the reservoir from a variety of mechanisms, and fracturing is one of them. Drilling ultra-extended reach horizontal wells gets you in contact with more of the reservoir. Fracture, you know, in a lateral sense, and drilling multilaterals gets you in contact with the reservoir. Fracturing gets you in contact with vertical extensions of the reservoir. So you can do both. One gets you lateral extent, the other one gets you vertical extent.
Senator French.
And while we're on that topic, is it possible that, out of some of the new technology advancements, 3D, 4D seismic, drill bit sensors, other things like that, do those potentially reduce the number of wells you have to drill and the number of feet you have to drill? That is, you're more accurate. You sort of get it right the first time. Does that make sense?
Senator French, the new types of information that we can acquire makes it easier to stay in the reservoirs, find the reservoirs, identify the reservoirs. So in that context, they do they help the economics of the well because you don't make as many mistakes. You know where you are.
Sure. You're. As much as that's interesting, that doesn't tell you how much oil you hit. It just tells you how many feet you drilled. Right. Thank you.
Slide number 19 is a plot of the active drilling and workover rigs for its total for Alaska. We didn't have time to break out North Slope. But you can see that there hasn't been much variability since 2006. Maybe there was a we lost a few rigs in 2009. Looks like in 2011 we've come back up. Most of those rigs are on the North Slope. Recently, their Cook Inlet may have subtracted a little bit out from the North Slope. I mean, from the total. For example, in 2011, I'd say that the number of rigs on the North Slope tracks these bar charts until recently, and then Cook Inlet's gotten maybe a little bit higher percentage of rigs than it has in the past. Slide number 20 is just the drilling rigs. We've taken out the workover rigs, and you can see somewhat of an increase in 2011. It's pretty slow through 2000, or pretty low through 2009, relatively, until 2011. We got a few more in there, and these are average wells, average rigs through the quarter. That's why you might see percentages of rigs on here. It's an average over a three-month period. Thank you, Ms. Engineer. Okay, slide 21, workover rigs. There, this probably needs to be explained a little bit more, and with that, I won't step on Commissioner Forrester's toes anymore. I'll let her explain slide number 22 and slide number 23, which is a breakdown of what these workover rigs actually did.
Slide number 22 shows the workover activity in the area of maintenance and repair. Slide number 23 will show another group of workover types. But again, this one is just for fixing things. The red bar part of the bars shows the number of workovers done to repair casing, tubing, or wellheads. This is just to keep mechanical integrity of the wellbore. The green section of the bar shows the number of workovers done for pump maintenance or replacement, and that's for wells that use downhole electric submersible pumps to get their oil out of the ground. You know, most of the wells at Prudhoe Bay are gas lift, and the ESPs are used at Millie Point, Schrader Bluff.
Heavy oil.
More used in the heavy oil, exactly. The blue section of the bar shows the number of workovers done for scale and corrosion control work. Those are chemical treatments pumped.
Senator French.
Is that where you'd use, say, a coiled tubing unit? Would that count as a workover rig in this example?
Senator French, the chair, yes. You could place chemicals with a coiled tubing unit.
That would count as a workover well.
Yes. Yes.
There's no rig. There's no big derrick. You're just putting tubing down the hole and then injecting some acid or something.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
And the small purple strip at the top catches all other maintenance and repair work done, but you know, it's just a little of this, a little of that. The next slide shows all of the workover activity done for production enhancement. Of course, repair is necessary for production maintenance, but production enhancement is depicted on this slide. The red portion of each bar shows the workovers done to add perforations to open up new section of the reservoir to flow into the well. The green portion shows the number of workovers done to stimulate, either with acid jobs or hydraulic fractures. The blue part shows the number of workovers done to isolate gas or water, you know, to squeeze off or in other ways mechanically isolate the stuff that we don't want so that there's more room for the oil to be produced. The purple part of the chart shows the number of workovers done to convert producers to injectors or vice versa as part of enhanced oil recovery. And finally, the tiny yellow sliver shows the number of workovers done to re-enter suspended wells and re-establish production in wells that have been shut in for a long period of time. Now, before I...
Senator French.
This brings up an interesting distinction that has kind of crept into the debate about oil taxes, unfortunately. So I just need to warn you that before you answer, there may be some ramifications to your answer. But recently we hear a lot about the difference between money that's spent on the North Slope to do maintenance and money that adds new production. What does this do? Is this maintenance spending or is this money that adds new production?
Well, this slide shows the workovers that are done to add new production. And the previous slide shows the workovers that are done for maintenance and repair of existing wells. So you got both.
And roughly, looks like about 2-1 the last couple of years, maintenance versus production. Is that fair? Looks like you got about 300 average. I'm just counting 300 average on page 23.
Yes.
And it looks like 600 average just roughly on page 22.
Well, and Senator French, through the chair, in a field that's been around as long as Prudhoe Bay and Kaparik have, you would expect that there would be a whole lot of maintenance work that needs to be done on the wells.
It just comes with the territory.
It just comes with the territory.
What happens? Go back to page 22, if you don't mind. You got a minute, Mr. Chairman? Thank
sure.
you. This would be classified as maintenance spending. It's a lot of work, but what happens if you don't do that maintenance spending? What happens to the production out of the well?
Eventually, you have to shut in the well, Senator French, through the chair. I'm sorry.
It becomes useless.
Well, it becomes, it could become dangerous to operate the well. The well could cease to operate. You know, in the case of a pump that's broken, if the pump doesn't work, you don't get any oil out of the well. In the case of tubing or casing that needs to be repaired, you've breached your mechanical integrity and the well could become unsafe.
If you don't spend on maintenance, can you lose production?
Well, if you have to shut the well in, you definitely can lose production.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Now, before, this is the end of the statistical and data slides, and before we move on to the next section, I wanted to remind you guys that when I came and talked to you last year, my first slide was a picture of Homer Simpson, and the quote was, "Statisticians can make the numbers say anything they want, and 47% of Americans know that." So just keep that in mind as you use all of these statistics. Let me switch to my...
They were back there.
Got to switch to a different PowerPoint. Okay. So I think Dan answered most of your questions, but there were a few bits that Senator Pascavan wanted me to discuss that haven't been hit on hard enough. So I'll talk a little bit about the current health of the North Slope reservoirs and a bit about what we see for the future potential. And when I talk about future potential, remember that the only thing you can guarantee about a prediction is that it will be wrong. In considering the health of the North Slope reservoirs, the bad news is also the good news. The health of all the fields on the North Slope depends to some degree on the health of Prudhoe Bay. Prudhoe Bay is the central nervous system and the circulatory system, and the rest of them are along for the ride. And that's been the case from the beginning, and it'll continue to be that way for a long time. But that's not a bad thing. With current technology, as I said earlier, there's still about 2 billion barrels left to be produced from the Prudhoe Reservoir. And that's just what's left, remembering that what I was saying about Thunder Horse, this is bigger than the last biggest discovery, the biggest discovery in this millennium in North America. Now, if we were able to produce that oil at the current rate with no decline, that would still mean another 15 years of production from the Prudhoe Reservoir, and no, that's not realistic. We will have decline, but that's just illustrative that, you know, even if we could maintain production with no decline, we have 15 more years from this field, so we should take good care of it. With current decline, Prudhoe will be producing for quite some time, as long as the oil price is sufficient to offset the costs and as long as there's a way to transport the oil. At some point, and I don't want to get into that debate, there won't be sufficient oil production from existing fields to keep taps going. We'll have to find another way to get the oil off the slope, or we'll have to find more production, and a lot of it. So we'll talk a little bit about that, too.
Mr. Chairman, just can you help us cross-reference the earlier testimony dealing with the expectations that there's 7 to 8 billion barrels of proven reserves in the slope to bring to market, and yet here we're looking at 2 billion in Prudhoe and a couple of billion in others, so that's about half of what has been discussed in other testimony, and I was just wondering if you can help us tie those loose ends together.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, could you tell me who gave that testimony?
Came out of the Gleason decision dealing with TAPs.
Okay. Senator Stedman, through the chair, we're using the existing reserve estimates that are generated by the Department of Natural Resources for our numbers. And we do a little checking ourselves, but according to our estimates and DNR's, Prudhoe Bay has 2 billion barrels left, and all the other reservoirs combined have another 2 billion.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you think it's realistic to think that we could get to 1 million barrels of oil going down the pipeline per day in the foreseeable future?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, it's conceivable, but as I will discuss, it's going to take a lot of investment and a lot of technology advances, a lot of new discoveries, and a lot of luck.
Can you apportion that?
A little of this, a little of that. and perhaps prayer.
I think opening ANWR and allowing the OCS to be developed, it's very realistic you could get there.
And that's going to take some luck.
Excuse me, Senator Wilkowski.
But realistically, if you've got 4 billion barrels left, then is that even possible to get 1 million barrels a day?
Senator Wilkowski, with the 4 billion that we've got that we know about right now and that we're counting on, I don't think that 1 million a day is possible. That's why I said we have to have new discoveries and new technology. so with the current decline, go back. Go back to first slide. First slide, yeah. With the current decline, Prudhoe will be producing for a long time. And but we will need additional discoveries. There, one place that new production might come from is the 20 billion barrels of known resource in the heavy and viscous oils that aren't commercially productive right now, and that'll take new technology, lots of investments, and lots of technology.
Let me. I really have a problem. You just said 20 billion barrels of viscous and heavy oil. I've heard 23 billion barrels. I've heard 26 billion barrels from people. And you guys are the ones that really should know. So you say 20 billion barrels, and that's your best estimate, or is that the company's best estimate? Whose estimate is that?
Senator Wagner, that's a round number. You know, there's more than 20 billion barrels of potential resource in heavy and viscous oil, and I apologize for not having it all in there. This was a talking number because, you know, it's going to become reserves in little bitty bits. There's a wide variation in viscosity of that 20-plus billion barrels, and we're going to figure out a way to get a half a billion of it commercial and then another half a billion of it commercial and then maybe 2 billion. You know, and over a long period of time, we're going to crack little bitty nuts. And in doing so, we may discover another 2 or 3 billion. So for this conversation, I apologize. I didn't feel like getting that number to its full level was necessary, but I can respond to you next week with what our number, or later this week with what our big number is on total potential of viscous and heavy.
I'd sure like to get that. And
I will do that.
And so it's all technology driven, of course, what would be recoverable. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Yeah, just following up on that, do you know what the total amount of booked reserves is on the North Slope?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I don't, but the operators are only booking as proven reserves what they can get with current technology, and that's a little bit of the Kuparuk Westsac and the Milne Point Crater Bluff, and whatever the total booking is for the Nikaichuk, because Nikaichuk is completely heavy oil, viscous oil.
Senator Stedman?
This is a follow-up on that. Do you feel that the state of Alaska's resource owner should have an accurate account of what is booked and what is filed with the Security and Exchange Commission and overseeing our field?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I'm stepping outside of my area of expertise in SEC filings, but I'm guessing that those are publicly available.
Can I
follow-up?
Yeah, I was just kind of curious. I mean, it doesn't really answer the question. You know, I guess the answer I heard was you assume that they're publicly available, but there seemed to be some confusion and differences of opinion in some of the past testimony for what those numerics are, and we've had documents shown to us submitted to the Securities and Exchange Commission talking about particular numerics, and I'm just curious, just as a citizen of the state, why we would have any misunderstanding or differences in opinion on those reserve numbers. As a resource owner, I would think we would have that nailed down.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, reserve estimates are dependent upon what you assume as a cutoff in minimum rate at which it's no longer economic to produce. They're dependent upon what your price forecast is and at what level you consider yourself to go negative in and it's no longer producible. And there's a bit of an art to decline curve analysis and the other techniques that are used. So until about 2005, both the AOGCC and the DNR did annual reserve estimates. And because of all of the assumptions you have to make and the little bit of art that's involved, our numbers never were exactly the same. And so rather than cause confusion and duplicate effort, we quit doing them because the DNR has engineers and geologists that are every bit as good as ours, and they can do that work as well as we can. But, again, all of those different assumptions go into the prediction of what you're going to do in the future. So it's not in the bank. It's a forecast. It's a prediction. There is going to be some variation from one person's interpretation to another's.
And Mr. Chairman, I think that would be probably a question for DNR when we drill into that. Just as a citizen of Alaska, one of the, co-mingled owners of the asset, I would think the state would have that number if it changes every year due to economic conditions or what have you. I would expect it to be reposted, but it seems to me that there's quite a discrepancy over the information that we've seen in previous testimony here and documents and some of the conversations that we've had. They're not even close.
Senator French?
This is a more general question, but just with respect to the Gleason decision, have you reviewed it or have you gotten a briefing on the decision? Just as commissioners?
Senator French, the chair, no, we have not.
Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The former director of the Oil and Gas Division for Alaska testified before the U.S. Senate back in May that with the exception of development of heavy oil resources, the natural field declines cannot be replaced without access to production from federal lands in the OCS. There are no, and this is a quote, there are no known conventional resources on state or native lands that are likely sufficient to replace the decline in the existing production rates. I'm just curious if you would agree with that statement.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. With what we know now, I think we need to get the OCS opened in order to stop the decline. And I don't think that the viscous and heavy oils can be that technology advances can make that commercial rapidly enough to stem the decline. I don't think with 10 exploratory wells and a 10% success rate per exploratory drilling that exploratory drilling is going to make it happen onshore. I think we need the OCS, and I'd love to see ANWR and the MPRA opened as well.
Mr. Chairman, may I intrude?
Yes, you may.
The comment I would make, the key word is known. There could be onshore. And I mean that's happened throughout the history of oil exploration. Is you go, oops, I found an elephant. Didn't know it was there.
We hope you're right.
He's a geologist. He's more optimistic than I am.
Realistic.
It's always about the rocks, isn't it?
Yeah. Is this what I did?
Go ahead. Proceed, please.
Next page. Is that okay? I was asked to talk a little bit about current and future North Slope activity. You've seen plenty of slides characterizing the current activity levels, and I hope that from looking at those you've drawn the same conclusions that I have, that there's a lot of activity on the North Slope. new and existing operators are drilling exploratory wells. Existing operators are drilling field expanding and infill development wells everywhere from Ugarook to Prudhoe Bay. Operators are performing remedial well work on existing wells, everything from repair work to production enhancement work. And as for the future, we don't see a cliff or a mountain. In other words, we don't have any data that would make us think that things are going to change dramatically in the next few years. Things should be going on about the same for the next few years. Now, two things could change that picture. If any of the exploratory wells is a success, we might enjoy another Tarn, Ugarook, Nikaichuk, or North Star. Or a technology breakthrough could increase the recovery from existing fields or unlock the door to some of that 20 billion barrels of heavy and viscous oil potential. And the only other thing that could make a dramatic change in activity level would be a dive in oil price or some other catastrophe that would curtail the operator's ability to spend. But short of any of those changes, it looks like business is as usual has been for the last few years, should be continuing for a few. And I hope that answered the question that Senator Passman asked.
And that includes a 5-6% decline each year, right?
Oh, I was talking about activity level. I was talking about drilling and workovers. Yeah. Okay. I was asked to talk about decline curve analysis of the ANS reservoirs. As I said a minute ago, we at the AOGCC used to do full field decline curve analyses of all the Alaska reservoirs as part of our annual reserves determination. And every year we'd publish a reserve estimate for all the fields. And every year the DNR would do the same thing. And then we'd get a million questions about why our numbers weren't identical. So we quit doing it. That said, we still do decline curve analyses for individual wells or small portions of fields to evaluate projects that the operators are proposing to do with us, proposing to get our approval to do, and then to check on the performance of those projects to see if they're doing what they were supposed to do. But for full field decline curve analysis, we rely on DNR because their engineers and geologists are as capable as ours. And that was a question that Senator Passman had wanted me to address. And another question that he had was, what do we see at the AOGCC as the role of new technology in the future of North Slope production? Technology advances have already played a huge role in North Slope production, moving Prudhoe Bay from an 8 billion barrel field to a 13 billion barrel field, making the viscous plays at West Sac, Schrader Bluff, and Nikaichuk commercial, and soon, we hope, enabling BP to move forward with its Liberty project. So technology's already been huge, and there's no reason to think that it won't continue to be huge. In my opinion, advancing technology will continue to be a key component of assuring a long and healthy future for North Slope production. New technologies will increase recovery from existing fields. New technology will enable operators to capitalize on that 20 billion barrels of heavy and viscous oil potential. And it will unlock the potential for gas hydrates, for shale oil, for shale gas, and who knows what else. And also, in my opinion, the operators have two incentives to continue to push for those new technologies. First, they've got the infrastructure is already there. If they're going to go out and explore, why not go and explore in some place where you've already got a great infrastructure instead of going out to some place where you have to build everything from scratch. So, you know, they've got it here. Why not just continue to cultivate it? And the other incentive is when they're done, they've got to clean it up. And so the longer that they can put that off, that's going to be an enormous expenditure, and they're not going to get any oil for it. So the longer into the future they can delay dismantlement and plugging and abandonment and remediation, the healthier their bottom line is going to look. So that's a huge incentive to keep the North Slope healthy. So,
Senator Stevens.
Just a quick question on that, because I remember reading the history books about the development of TAPS and the discussion of a fund that would be there to dismantle the pipeline. But now we learn that it's really not true. Is that the case?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, I don't know what kinds of funds the companies have set up for themselves, but while they've got those, if they have those funds, they're in a bank drawing interest, and once they start having to pull out of that bank and spending that money, it's gone. I don't know what funds they have in place, but I can guarantee you that having money someplace in your pocket is going to be a lot more attractive to you than pulling it out and sprinkling it around and not getting anything back for it. That's all I'm saying with that. But all of that said, that's just my opinion. And this is a discussion that you ought to have with the oil companies to get their views. They're the experts on their planning. The last question that Senator Pascvan asked me to discuss a little bit with you guys was what we saw as the transition to it in the future and the influx of new operators. And the transition from just a few big companies on the North Slope to lots of smaller companies is part of the natural maturation of any basin. It happens everywhere. When I was growing up in Corpus Christi, Texas, every major had an office there. And now none of them does. But there are lots of little companies that have offices, little oil companies that have offices in Corpus Christi. And, you know, that's just the way it works. Of course, such a transition is a lot easier in places where the costs of doing business are a lot less than those that we have here in Alaska, in our harsh environment, and our uneasy access. But, you know, that transition is already beginning, and it will continue. Last year, you guys may remember that I gave you my African savanna analogy. Do you remember that? And I said that I'd like to remind you, I said it then, and I'd like to remind you of it now. The North Slope is kind of like the African savanna, and Prudhoe Bay is a big, beautiful animal, just let's say a zebra. The big companies are the lions, and the lions get there in a little herd, and they kill a zebra, and they all lie down around it and chow down, have a great meal. And as they're mellowing out and getting full, then the vultures and the hyenas get up their nerve, and they think it's safe to come in and start eating with them. And you know, we're seeing, and I don't mean to call anybody a vulture or a hyena, but
awfully close though.
But just wait. So we're starting to see other companies coming in, and they're nibbling at the bones and the pieces of meat that are still there, and that's a good thing. Now, unfortunately, as this poor zebra carcass continues to dwindle, the maggots move in, and we don't want the maggots. You remember that from last year? We like the lions, we like the hyenas, we like the vultures, but we just need to be careful not to let the maggots in up here.
Is that your conclusion?
No. It should be, but it's not. Another interesting phenomenon that could happen in Alaska, and it's happening right now in the lower 48, is that little companies are proving to the big companies something that can happen, and that's the shale development, the oil shales and the gas shales. And you see the big companies going, hey, I want a piece of that. And they're coming back into those areas that little companies that we'd never heard of 10 years ago are making their money off of. And we would love to see that happen with the shale oil and shale gas potential in the northern part of Alaska. There's another possible future for the North Slope. When I came here 20 years ago and started looking around, I predicted that one day the majors would throw the keys to somebody like ASRC and leave them to operate the North Slope fields. I still think that's possible. But I think it's farther in the future. Thanks to oil price and technology advances, I think the majors are going to keep the keys in their pocket longer. But I think that's a possible future, is when the North Slope fields become unattractive to the big companies, they pull out the keys and toss them to somebody more local who's here for the long haul and willing to catch those keys. And I'll close with that.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Thank both of you for coming. That's the end of our agenda today. Almost right on time. It's 5 till 5. With that, resource will be adjourned.